Hi, and welcome to Guideposts. I'm your volunteer reader, Sandy Summers. Today, we return to the archives and continue reading from the October 2016 issue of Guideposts with articles like The Long Way Home. Someone cares, pass it on. Girls just want to have fun. In February 2016, I finished treatment for breast cancer. I found that I had a hard time adjusting to normal life again. I wanted to surround myself with other women who had gone through the same thing, who could provide support that would be available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. I figured if I needed that, others probably did too. So I created a Facebook group called After Breast Cancer, Support the Girls. I also wanted my fellow survivors to have a way to give themselves a treat. Medical bills don't leave much room for extras. That's how Marvelous Mondays began. Every week, I hold a drawing for a gift card to a spa, a restaurant, or a movie theater. The monetary value of the card depends on my budget that week, but it's always at least $15, just enough to have a little fun. The group already has more than 200 members. Women are making friends and getting support from fellow survivors. It's exactly what I'd hoped it would be, and exactly what I needed. Karen Noblett, Houston, Texas. Bootiful. Halloween is my favorite holiday. It was my dad's favorite, too. He taught me how to sew, and we made costumes that let our skills shine. My son and daughter's love for the holiday helped me after Dad passed away. Watching them march in their school's Halloween parade reminded me of the fun that Dad and I used to have. Then last year, I heard other parents talking about how expensive Halloween costumes can be. I saw some kids without any. Time to break out the needle and thread. I asked around for outgrown or damaged costumes and shopped clearance sales. I repaired the costumes that could be saved and made some from scratch. I've made more than 40 costumes for kids in sizes ranging from infant to teen, including knights, skeletons, and my favorite, a spooky bride. I have a spot downtown where I can set up a stand to give them away. I can't wait. My dad will be there in every stitch and sequin. Amanda Mills, Walton, New York. Life of the Party. My mom is the upbeat type, but when we spoke on the phone the night before my birthday this past year, she sounded down. I thought she would be happy to hear that a friend was taking me out to lunch to celebrate since my husband would be out of town, but it only seemed to make things worse. What could I do from 450 miles away? I called my brother and sister-in-law who live closer to Mom. Missy, my sister-in-law, had a great idea. How about a long-distance birthday party, she said. While I was out with my friend at my favorite restaurant, Mom and Missy enjoyed their own party in my honor. Missy bought a bouquet of flowers and some cake to Mom's nursing home. Missy even brought along the present she was planning to send me so Mom could see it first. Thanks to video calling and picture messaging on our cell phones, we were all able to celebrate together. It was one of my most memorable birthdays, and Mom was the life of the party. Pamela Haskin, Cooper, Texas. Want more stories of kindness and caring? Go to someonecares.com to share your own story. Email us at sc@guideposts.org or write to Guideposts, Someone Cares, 110 William Street, Suite 901, New York, New York, 10038. Our Returning Troops, The Long Way Home. Despite her own wounds, this veteran wondered why she was allowed to survive when her comrades didn't. By Master Sergeant Adele Lohr, U.S. Air Force, retired, Nagasset, Rhode Island. I spent last spring doing something that might have stunned anyone who knows me, hiking deep in the backwoods on the Appalachian Trail, all by myself. Why would people think that so strange? Well, for one thing, I lost my right eye in a roadside bomb attack while serving in the military in Baghdad. That same bomb blew away much of my shoulder and part of my cheek. I'm slowly losing vision in my left eye, and I struggle to remember things that just happened, the result of traumatic brain injury. On top of everything else, I live with PTSD. It's not as bad as when I first came home from Iraq, but loud noises still scare me. I rarely get a full night's sleep. I scan my surroundings constantly. Doesn't sound much like a confident outdoors woman, does it? And yet, as I hiked through those lush eastern woodlands and topped out on peak after peak, there was no place on earth I'd rather have been. In my late 40s now, and there is nothing in my past to indicate that I'd end up a dedicated long-distance solo hiker. I grew up in a military family in Rhode Island. We did not hike. Outdoors for me was the backyard. Mom and Dad both served in the Navy, and my three older brothers went into the military too, so it was pretty obvious what I'd do after school. I joined the Air Force and became a law enforcement specialist. I moved up to become a special investigator and eventually found myself doing counterintelligence in Baghdad at the height of the fighting. One day in February 2006, I was told to assemble a team to meet with an informant in the city. I gathered a security detail and asked Dan, a civilian intelligence agent who worked as my partner, to accompany me. We piled into two SUVs and set out. A bomb detonated on the right side of our convoy. I was conscious long enough to know I'd been hurt. Then I passed out. I awoke 5 days later at a military hospital in Germany. It was there that someone told me Dan had been killed, along with Jesse, one of our National Guardsmen, on the security detail. All I could think was, why not me? I was a single woman with no children. Dan and Jesse were fathers. How could the God I prayed to as a kid allow such a thing to happen? How? Lying there in my hospital bed, I felt guilt and anger build inside me until they seemed to fill my soul. Why bother praying? God obviously doesn't care, if he was even there at all. I spent 3 months at Walter Reed Army Medical Center in Washington, D.C., enduring multiple surgeries until at last I had decent vision in my left eye, a prosthetic in my right eye, and a mostly functional shoulder. The treatment focused on my physical symptoms. Like a good airman, I pushed on, trying to ignore the deeper injury inside me. But I couldn't. I couldn't stop thinking about Dan and Jesse. Anger and guilt consumed me. I became anxious and withdrawn. I barely slept. One day, just to see what would happen, I walked into the chapel at Walter Reed. I lasted less than 5 minutes in the white wooden pews. The more I stared at the lectern up front, with its Bible lying open, the madder I got. I left Walter Reed and threw myself into work. I could no longer serve in a combat zone, so I transferred back to law enforcement, doing internal investigations at the Air Force Base in Colorado. That was a challenge, since my short-term memory was shaky and my shoulder injury made some of the physical aspects of the job more difficult. I was becoming a recluse and afraid even to leave my home. Finally, I couldn't take it. I got referred to the medical center at Fort Carson and was diagnosed with TBI and PTSD. Soon afterward, I took medical retirement. In 2013, I decided to return to Rhode Island, to the house I'd grown up in. By then, both my parents had died and the house stood vacant. One morning, shortly before moving back home, I woke up with the words echoing in my mind as if someone had been speaking in my sleep. You owe it to Dan and Jesse to keep living. I lay there stunned, and yet at the same time I felt more clear-headed than I had in years. The words rang deeply true. The question was, what to do about them? That very day I was on my computer and saw an email from an organization called No Barriers, just for veterans, climb Mount Whitney, the subject line said. I got emails like that all the time promoting stuff for veterans. Keep living. If I hadn't heard those words earlier that morning, I would have deleted the email without a thought. I checked on it instead. Even though climbing the tallest peak in the contiguous United States, 14,505 feet, was about the last thing I ever imagined myself doing. I'd heard of No Barriers. It was a nonprofit organization dedicated to helping disabled people gain confidence through wilderness adventures. It had a special mountain climbing program for veterans sponsored by Wells Fargo. I replied to the email asking for more information. I heard back almost right away. Would I be willing to talk by phone? Whoa. Cautiously, I answered yes. Soon I was on the phone with a cheerful, energetic woman who gently but persistently got me to tell my story and explain why doing something like climbing Mount Whitney might help me. I was surprised to hear myself say, I think a challenge like that might be just what I need to get out of my depression. I found an outdoors group in Rhode Island and began hiking and jogging to get in shape for the climb. At first, I had to force myself to go on the hikes. But they weren't as bad as I'd feared. The other hikers were willing to talk or not talk, whatever I felt comfortable with. Something about being in the woods seemed to mellow people out, including me. Soon I was looking forward to the outings. Late that spring, No Barriers flew me and a dozen or so other veterans to Colorado for a training hike in the Rockies. We hiked at high altitude and camped in snow. During a second outing, we worked on team building, walking blindfolded on a rope team and helping each other cross bridges and creeks. No one talked about their injuries, even though some of us were obviously wounded. It was as if the moment we arrived in the mountains, we became people again, just hikers, not troubled veterans. The mottos of No Barriers is that within you is stronger than what's in your way. Every step I took seemed to make those words more real. At last, we flew to California and assembled at the trailhead for Mount Whitney. Before us, the escarpment of the Sierra Nevadas rose precipitously. Whitney towered above it all. We hiked through sagebrush, then through sparse strands of pine, and finally emerged above the tree line into a rocky, barren wilderness. The more rugged the landscape grew, the more peaceful and confident I felt. As I lay at night under a canopy of stars, listening to the wind rustling my tent, it didn't matter whether I slept or not. I felt a presence in the wilderness, maybe the same presence that had spoken to me all those months ago, setting me off on this adventure. The day of the summit climb dawned clear. We left our heavy packs at a staging area and began the long, steep hike. I was nervous at first, but then I looked around at my teammates. If they could do it, so could I. And I did do it. Suddenly, the trail topped a rise, and we were there, at the jumbled rocky summit along with a few other hardy souls. The wind blew strong and cold, but I didn't care. I stood there gazing up and down the Sierra Nevada range, out toward Death Valley and beyond. Surrounded by all that beauty, that abundant evidence of God's powerful work in the world, I knew I was going to be okay. I didn't have to understand why Dan and Jesse died. What mattered was living, for Dan and Jesse, for myself, and for the one who made me and sustains me, the one who led me here. For years, I'd been convinced that God either didn't exist or didn't care. Now I knew it was me who stopped listening for his voice and looking for his love. Well, here they were, in all their rugged and unchangeable glory. The minute I got home from Whitney, I knew I needed another challenge. I made plans to hike the Appalachian Trail, which transverses the eastern landscape I love. I started at the trail's southern terminus in Georgia. I relished the solitude, yet I welcomed the company of fellow hikers when I met them. I wore a GPS tracking device and posted on Facebook whenever I was in Wi-Fi range, so my siblings knew where I was. I had to pull off the trail a few times for various reasons, but I know I'll finish. If not this year, then someday. I'm living now. That's the toughest and most rewarding trail of all. One I never walk alone. I'm Sandy Summers, and you're listening to Guideposts on Sun Sounds of Arizona, a 24-hour reading and information service for people who can't read print due to a disability. If you missed any part of this program, you may access it anytime on demand at www.sunsounds.org. In addition to the bi-monthly Guidepost magazine, each week we may be reading some of Guidepost's other daily devotions or inspiring stories from Guideposts online. Our returning troops, take charge of your finances. Financial readiness. The Warriors to Summits program helped Adele Lohr deal with the emotional and psychological challenges of civilian life. But returning veterans like her also have to deal with practical matters, including finances. Here are some key principles for successful money management for returning troops and for the rest of us. Make saving a habit. Every time you receive money, set some aside. Automatically deposit a percentage of your income into a savings account. Start small, with an amount that's comfortable for you, even if it's as little as 5%, and increase it with time. To save for retirement, take the advantages of a 401k or a Roth IRA. Spend smart. Budgeting should be an everyday activity, one that involves all the decision makers of the household. Set aside money each week for larger expenses that you know are coming up, such as car repairs, appliances, or holiday gifts. To decide whether a purchase is necessary, ask yourself, what would happen if I don't buy it now? Review your bank and credit card statements regularly. They will remind you where your money is going. Use credit wisely. Shop for a credit card with a low annual fee and interest rate. Pay off your balances as quickly as you can. If you apply for a loan, look for a lender with a good reputation. Understand the terms of the loan agreement before you sign. Every time you borrow money and keep your promise to pay it back, you are strengthening your ability to borrow the next time. If you find yourself in trouble with debt, take action early. Call your lender and work with it to decide your next steps, or contact the National Foundation for Credit Counseling at debtrelief.nfcc.org/military. Bank on it. Find a financial institution that offers safe, secure, and convenient services. Get to know your options. Savings accounts are a great place to set money aside to grow for your future. For paying your monthly bills and making day-to-day purchases, a checking account is better. Keep your receipts and record your transactions. That will help you avoid overdrafts. Take advantages of the services your bank may offer, like online banking, mobile banking, direct deposit, and automatic transfers. For more expert advice, order your free copy of our financial readiness booklet at guidepost.org/FR booklet. Living with Cancer, It Takes Two to Fight Cancer by Kathy Kino, West Palm Beach, Florida. I tapped the steering wheel and waited for my 9-year-old son, Townsend, to appear in the crowd of students streaming out of the elementary school doors, hoping he'd show up late. That way, I'd have an excuse to put off telling him. But there he was, making his way to my car, a big grin on his face. "Hi, Mom," he said. He threw his backpack in the back seat and launched into a recap of his day. I plastered a smile on my face, nodding along. Inside, though, my stomach churned. How in the world was I going to break the news to him? I'd been sitting on it for a week, ever since my ultrasound came back, showing nodules in my breasts. The report recommended following up in 6 months, but I had just had this feeling, a nudge from God to get a biopsy. I'd been a trauma nurse for 11 years, a hospital chaplain for 3, and I'd just started a master's program in holistic nursing. I was no stranger to cancer. I knew you could never be too careful, so I called a doctor friend at the hospital where I worked and scheduled the biopsy right away. She sat me down in the same room I brought patients to when the news was difficult. "I'm so sorry," she said. "It's breast cancer." The room swirled around me. I'd have to have a double mastectomy. Chemo and radiation were possibilities. At the moment, though, I could only think about one thing, one person, Townsend. He was my whole world. His father and I had divorced when he was just a toddler. Townsend saw his dad every other weekend, but the rest of the time we were inseparable. We played golf, cooked dinner, went to the beach on the weekends, and even prayed together. I was a constant presence at his school, where I volunteered regularly. Townsend and I were a great team, but at the same time, he was just a kid. How could he possibly handle something like cancer? I glanced at Townsend next to me in the front seat. He had his math textbook propped open on his lap, was scribbling answers to homework. I took a deep breath. "Townsend, honey," I said, "I have to tell you something." He didn't look up. "The doctor found little lumps in my chest, so in a few weeks I'm having surgery. Your grandma's coming to stay with us until I get better." Townsend stopped writing. "Do you have breast cancer?" he asked. I didn't answer. Who knew what he'd heard about cancer at school? "Do you, Mom? Do you have it?" "Yes, honey, I do," he said. I said, "But it's going to be okay, I promise." He didn't say anything for a while, then asked if we could make a stop at the mall. I was confused. Shopping was the one hobby we didn't share. "I want to get some of those pink socks," he said. "You know, the ones for breast cancer." We bought all the pink socks we could find. That night before bedtime, Townsend and I prayed as usual. This time we focused on my health. Alone in my room, I tossed and turned in bed. I knew the devastating effects of cancer only too well. I might not be able to cook with Townsend or go golfing with him or help him with homework. There were going to be scars. I could lose my hair. How would he cope with all that? "Oh, Lord," I prayed, "I just want to be here to raise my son. No matter what happens, please, please take care of Townsend." I tried to keep things normal for him in the weeks leading up to my surgery, I smiled through my pain, even at the hospital after surgery. Townsend's dad brought him by every day to visit. Townsend told me stories, did his homework by my bedside, and made funny faces at the hospital food. We were doing a pretty good job of keeping things upbeat. The first day back home, though, I took off my bandages and stared at the 65 staples across my chest. I hardly recognized myself. I wanted to crawl under my bed and cry. But I pulled myself together before school let out. Townsend gave me a big hug the moment he saw me. "You're still the most beautiful mommy I've ever seen," he said. Somehow he knew exactly what I needed to hear. It took a good month to get completely back on my feet. Then radiation started. My mother stayed with us and took care of everything. She made Townsend's lunch, did the laundry, helped him with homework. I was so thankful, but at the same time, I've never felt so helpless. I was used to being in charge, the single mom who did everything for her son, the one who drove him all over town, who helped him study for tests, who played football with him in the front yard. Now I could barely lift my arms. I was stuck on the couch. Townsend would plop down next to me and we'd watch all the cooking competition shows on TV. He'd comment on everything from the way Bobby Flay grilled a burger to what he himself would cook if he were given just 5 ingredients to work with. One morning, halfway through my treatments, I looked through my wardrobe and realized I had nothing to wear. Well, nothing that fit me anymore. Townsend, my mother, and I drove to the mall. Maybe I could find some cute top with ruffles to camouflage my new shape. A few shops in, I felt myself getting tired. Radiation was really getting the best of me. It was like having a bad sunburn, only much worse. "You okay, honey?" my mom asked. I nodded if I could just find one shirt, then I would be good to go. We stopped in another store. I felt so exhausted, so unlike myself, I burst into tears. We went home and I collapsed on the couch, then slept for 3 hours straight. I woke up to the sound of pots and pans banging in the kitchen. "What are you guys doing in there?" I called out. "Just wait," Townsend said. An hour later, he emerged from the kitchen with a tray. He carried it to the couch. "May I present to you salmon and roasted potatoes in an herb butter sauce," he said, beaming. He had been studying the nutrition brochures that I'd picked up on how to eat healthy during radiation. "You've got your proteins, your veggies, and a touch of salt." I studied the artful arrangement of the food on the plate, the silverware and folded napkin. "Townsend, this looks like it came from one of those TV shows," I said. "You made all this?" "Yep," he said. "And tomorrow I'll make your famous grilled chicken." "He didn't even use a cookbook," my mother said. "This kid's a pro." I looked at Townsend, who was smiling from ear to ear. He suddenly looked very tall for 9 years old. I'd worried so much about how he handled my cancer, but here he was cooking for me, boosting my spirit so I wouldn't have to fight alone. He'd be okay no matter what happened. I knew God was watching out for us. I made it through my treatments with flying colors. There were many challenges to come after that, but Townsend stuck by my side through it all. God had answered my prayer. He'd taken care of Townsend. What I hadn't foreseen, though, was Townsend taking care of me. Mysterious ways, more than coincidence. Mysterious ways, more than coincidence. The last blush of daylight had faded from the sky. Now the unfamiliar road looked sinister. I gripped the wheel of my old sedan, anxious to get home. I had been visiting my friend Marie at a Christian retreat in upstate New York and stayed longer than I intended. "Call when you get home," she said. She sounded a little worried. I was doing fine until I noticed that a warning light on my dashboard had come on. My engine temperature was in the red zone. I did a lot of driving for my father's feed business, and he drilled into my head that hot on the gauge meant stop the car or the engine would seize. But I was an hour from home in the middle of nowhere. I didn't have AAA, a cell phone, or much money on me. I didn't feel safe approaching a stranger. What if I stopped someplace and the people were out of their minds on drugs, or worse, creeps looking for easy prey? Lord, where can I pull over? Up ahead on the right was a house with a light outside. For some reason, I felt drawn to it. I parked in front and knocked timidly on the door. A woman answered. "Oh," I thought, "you were my kid," she said. "I've been waiting up for them to get back from a church trip. What can I help you with?" "It seems safe." I explained that my car was having trouble. "You're in the right place," the woman said. "Pull around to my husband's auto shop in the back." "Auto shop?" Sure enough, behind the house there stood a full-service garage, just out of sight of the road. The woman's husband popped the hood of my car and soon found the problem, a hole in my radiator. "I've got an old radiator," he said. "It'll hold you till you get home, but make sure to see your mechanic so he can replace it." He refused to take a dime for the parts or labor. I thanked the couple and went on my way. Finally home, I called Marie. "Thank God you made it," she said. "I saw a big puddle in your parking space after you left. I was praying for you." I brought my car to my mechanic, as the man had advised, but it turned out the radiator he had given me was perfectly fine. No need to replace it at all. Kathy Trowbridge, Akron, Pennsylvania. Want more miracles? Get Mysterious Ways magazine at guidepost.org/MW. That's all the time we have today for Guideposts. Thank you for listening. My name is Sandy Summers. Stay tuned for more great programming on Sun Sounds.